Have you had any flashes of memories about being a teenager here that have come up since we've been talking that you want to get on record?
Well, a teenager. No, I can't think of anything specific.
Well, what about going beyond? Teenagers, you're now 20, the earthquake has happened, you're going into adulthood, you're still living in Kodiak.
Yes, that's why I couldn't think of anything about being a teenager. I'm thinking early 70s. I was married and had Alicia was born in 72, and my association.
Pardon, and Alicia is your daughter?
Yes, my only child, Alicia Drabek, had been born, and I'd spent a couple of years getting to know the family, and I'd heard stories from my mother-in-law and her sister about being raised in a fog neck. And I'd already become firmly rooted as a Kodiakan and read a lot of history, been fascinated by the history of Kodiak. And so to hear stories about a fog neck were wonderful, I guess you'd say. Both Magnol and Laura were very good storytellers, and they told about their youth being raised in a fog neck.
Could you, Magnol and Laura, who?
Magnol Drabek and Laura Freeman. They had their maiden names were Lart was Larson, and they were Olga Larson's daughters, two of her 16 children, and they were in a fog neck family. And in their stories to me of what it was like being raised in a fog neck, they were good storytellers, and I didn't even really think about that. Just through the course of visiting family, these stories came to me. And when Alicia was about 6 months old, I had the opportunity to go with friends, one time, one weekend, Maria and Andre Nault and Tony and Alicia and I went to a fog neck. Actually, we camped on Raspberry Island, but we skiffed over in the day to a fog neck village.
This is before or after the earthquake?
After it was 72, 1972. And when we went from one end of the village to the other, it took us all day long. I could not believe the impact of having known Olga Larson. I'd briefly lived in Port Lyons, and so which is where, after the earthquake, a fog neck was destroyed during the earthquake, and everyone from a fog neck resettled. The majority resettled in Port Lyons, the village built for them by major input from the Lions Clubs, hence the name Port Lyons. Their water was fouled in a fog neck, and several other things had gone wrong. So they had to depart a fog neck and move elsewhere, and were saddened by having to leave their structured village. It was the largest village on these islands. And the day, I had no idea of the impact that the stories that those ladies had told me. And when we spent the day walking from one end of the village to the other, and knowing so many of the people, we'd walk by Nelson's house, we'd walk by Chichinoff's house, we went into Chichinoff's house and the outbuildings, and we were unable to go into Olga Larson's house because the lake had extended. And well, no, we did go in. It was a couple of feet of water, but we had canary boots, and so we did go in there. And all the stories, it was like people were in the buildings because as I was, Tony would say, this was the Nelson's house. He'd spent several summers there, so he knew whose house was whose.
And Tony was your husband?
He was my husband at the time. And his mother and his aunt's stories made that whole place more than just an interesting, large, abandoned village. It was like it was alive, and it was beautiful.
Can you recall any particular story that just sticks out in your mind that you'd like to have recorded as a part of this oral history project?
Well, I know that there was a path. The houses were, there was the ocean and the beach, and the houses were fairly close to the beach. And then the forest was behind that. And just beyond the houses and slightly into the forest, there was kind of a pathway, you know, kind of a protected pathway, well-worn pathway. And there wasn't any one specific story, but apparently when the kids would go from school to church to home or vice versa, the main means of travel was to go back towards the woods and through that path, or across, over that path. And it just struck me as every story that related to traveling to and from school or to and from church, you could just see Laura and Magnell walking along with firm instructions from their mother in their minds, heading for church. You know, rather, they would rather have been sleeping in their beds. And well, it was like they were all there. It was like all the experiences that they had came alive to me while I was there looking at this abandoned village.
Okay.
I do remember a specific story. Magnell told me that the Larsons and the Chichenoffs lived right next door to each other in a fog neck. So they're like family. To this day, they're like family, just from having, you know, the close proximity. One of the Chichenoff girls, there was a ship that came into the bay that was, I don't know if it was a military ship or what, but it was a rather large ship. And they had come in on a skiff and they were going to share some food supplies. They wanted some specific things, and they had an abundance of some other things, and they wanted to do a transfer of stuff. And all the young girls were kind of titillated by, here's a whole ship full of fellows, so they wanted to help take the stuff out there. And apparently, one of the Chichenoff girls was in the skiff, and the skiff sank. And the rest of the people on the shore were unable to do anything. And Sonny lost one of his sisters that day. All they were doing was taking foodstuffs out to the boat. And that's the kind of realities that they had to deal with in living at the edge of an ocean. Those kinds of tragedies, regular, but they weren't unknown.
And I gather from your earlier comment that you lost your father earlier, and was this also a tragedy at sea?
Well, sort of, kind of. My father died when he was 40 years old. He wasn't living in Kodiak. He'd taken a few months' job. East Point Cannery here was run and owned by Mr. Bendixson, I forget his first name, but yeah, my dad had worked with him in conjunction with fishing out of Seattle and here, and Bendixson had a boat he wanted worked on. My dad lived on the boat in Lake Union in the Seattle area, and one weekend he was going to fly up here, and about 2 days before he was due to be here, my mother received a call, and apparently he was due to come up that Friday, but we never knew the particulars of it, but he drowned in Lake Union right beside the boat. The boat was tied to a little short dock, and when they found him, he had a bump on his head, and he'd drowned 4 days earlier, and we didn't quite know whether it was malicious or an accident. Various family members were firmly rooted in both ideas, but it's kind of moot point. He drowned.
I don't mean to stick on a morbid subject for an extended period of time, but that strikes me as something that kids growing up in Kodiak would have to be able to relate to each other with. Living next to the sea, having family members, brothers, fathers involved with the sea, do you recall any specific experiences where you, as a teenager, related to other teenagers in tragedies related to the sea?
Well, I remember the family stories about everybody knew about the Skonberg family, that a variety of the men had lost their legs in a skiffing accident. There was sisters and brothers in a boat, and apparently the storm came up, and the sisters went under the tarp, and the men did what they could to secure the safety of their trip. And in the course of things, I believe at least two of the men lost one or both of their legs. I don't know if it was hypothermia or what, but it's just something that I can't remember having any specific conversations with people, but as a teenager at least, about fishing deaths. But it is a reality. Every year it's a reality. It's sort of like at the end of the year, how many people have you lost? That goes on today. It's one of the reasons why I like the IFQs, because it means that you won't have these 24-hour halibut openings that are unsafe and unwise from a human standpoint, and you don't put people in jeopardy over trying to make a buck. You get a quota and you get to fish for it in a reasonable amount of time and in a reasonable, prepared, safe fashion, because anything you can do to make the fishing industry safer is a logical move. People aren't expendable in my view, and yet it is a reality that people in the fishing industry have to face all the time here.
As a teenager, you were here living in Kodiak during the heyday of the king crab fishery and
yes.
That whole aura of big time fishing, big time money. What was that like?
It was like the gold rush times. Exactly like the gold rush times. That's the kind of, it was a boom time. People were very, very wealthy. I think that's when gold nugget watches got so popular. You know, you could plaster gold nugget rings and watches on yourself if you really made it big. And it was a way to show you were a highliner. And it was it was like I imagine the Skagway Gold Rush days were. And people didn't always spend terribly wisely either. It was kind of a feast and famine thing. You make a big season, so you buy all new furniture, or you go on a grandiose vacation or build a new home, and then it's all gone until you go fish again, until there are no more king crab. This is a terribly good example for people that go behind you, but was interesting to observe.
We've talked a little bit about a sense of belonging and being a part of the community and relating this oral history to your personal experiences, and you had some comments on that.
Oh, well, I mentioned that I was slightly reluctant to speak of specific personal experiences because some of them were negative. Perhaps they're noteworthy whether they're negative or not. I hadn't been here too long, maybe 6 months, when we had the eighth grade graduation here in Kodiak, and that was 62, I guess. And I remember it was an unusual thing. We had a huge ceremony. I wasn't prepared for such a huge ceremony for eighth grade graduation, but apparently many people, it was probably one of the last big deal ceremonies for eighth grade. Apparently a lot of kids didn't go beyond that up until the 60s. That was it. So they made the ceremony really whiz bang. And there was an onstage thing where it was just like high school graduation. And I felt like I didn't belong, and at the end of it, at the end of the whole ceremony, we all stood and sang the state song, Eight Stars of Gold on a Field of Blue, Alaska's Flag, May It Mean to You. And here's all these kids that have gone to school for all these years together, born and raised together, the majority of them, probably 50 to 75% of those kids had all gone to school together. And I didn't even know the song. I couldn't even by myself get through the Alaska flag song. And so after that ceremony, everyone was to go to the cafeteria and have refreshments and, you know, chit-chat with parents and friends. And I don't even remember seeing my folks. I just remember that the stage was empty and I was standing there crying because I thought, well, I'm not part of this. I'm not part of this at all. And it just felt strange to not be part and parcel of what was happening and yet be involved in it.
At what time or age do you think it was before you really started feeling like you belonged in Kodiak or part of Kodiak?
Oh, probably a little bit by the end of high school, because, you know, then all those same kids from the eighth grade, we all went through high school together, and I kind of got used to watching all the Navy kids that were here for 2-3 max years come and go. So I saw the sense that, you know, other people get kind of whiplashed around and, you know, do just fine. And then here all the locals, we stayed on. And to me, that's one of the things I enjoy most about this community is today. There's still 20-some of us still here.
Oh, when you say 20-some of you from your
high school class, high school graduating class, I think we somewhere between 20 and 22 of the 60-some of us that graduated together are still here. And we still, I won't say chum around together, but we still get together on a 3-4-time-a-year basis and see each other.
When you get together, what kind of stories come up? What are the stories that come up that you laugh about high school?
Well, stupid stuff that we did in high school, and you know how intrigued we were by, oh, I guess I didn't ever see it, but apparently one of the big laughs of the early 60s high school pranks was to put some kids, a double door at the end of a hallway, they somehow took out the dividing thing between the two doors, and they put one of the teacher's Volkswagens in the hallway. And it was like we all felt bonded together, that something wonderful had happened because, I don't know, maybe it's one up on the authoritarians or something. But we all thought that was pretty cool, and we laugh about it to this day. We a lot of times just share stories about, you know, our children and our vacations and our day-to-day life, but we're quite often taken back to basketball games, and do you remember this one screwing up or that? And we laugh about dumb stuff, dumb, stupid senior picnics and crazy stuff that happens, and freshman initiation, who, you know, who like Nancy Waller initiated me when I was a freshman, and then she runs Highliner now, and then she had me eating peanut butter at command and trying to talk and sing while eating peanut butter. Dumb stuff like that, you know, silly stuff. I can't think of anything else off the top of my head. There's all sorts of stupid things that high school kids do. We talk about it occasionally.
Hey, jumping around once again, we're back to young adulthood, and I've heard you make reference to the fact that you and your husband and your child tindered for a while. Anything you want down on the record about those experiences?
Well, that was probably the most fun I've had in my life, actually, getting to know all those many people. We had a Tinder run in Uyak Bay that did it 3 summers in a row,
From when to when?
79 to 81, on a huge World War II power scow that has since sunk. It was a derelict of a thing, but it was huge and comfortable. And in the protection of Uyak Bay, that was just fine. It didn't have to be any safer than it was. It would always worry me when we'd go down Shelikof and around back to Kodiak, but when in Uyak, it didn't bother me at all. We picked up fish from set netters on an average of about 12 sights a day. And so, as you can see, picking up 12 sights a day, having them pitch all their fish from their skiff into a brailer bag and then put it on deck and cover it with ice and burlap and such. It took round the clock. It was a round the clock operation. There were three adults and Alicia. My daughter Alicia was maybe, she was 6 to 8 during those times. And a lot of set netters are families. It's a family operation more than 50% of the time. So she'd quite frequently stay with those people that had children, and they wanted a little, you know, fresh entertainment for their children, you know. So she met lots of people during that time. And almost to a man, the people I met then are still some of my best friends. Really great people. And that's the kind of thing that made me love this island, was to see that, to have the opportunity to go round that island from Kodiak all the way around to there. And we one time even went up into Larsen Bay to the head of it and walked up over to the Karluk River. It's so different down on that end of the island than it is up here. It's just a beautiful, beautiful area. And to me, those experiences are precious. They're experiences much like that tendering experience. Also had an opportunity to trap otter and fox in Euganic Bay, which is the next bay up from that Uyak, and spent 3 months down there and saw the beauty of Euganic Bay. And when Alicia was an infant, 10 months old, had an opportunity to winter watch Moser Bay Cannery, which is almost at the south end of the island. And having the chance to see the variety of beautiful spots in nature that are on this very island has made me just appreciate the beauty of this place and made me feel ashamed that I ever thought it was a dusty burg, because it's a beautiful, beautiful place.
You also spent some time as a young adult working in canneries here. Mm-hmm. Any reflections on those experiences?
Yes, that's an odd bit of work to do. I probably, as a teenager, just after high school, and as a young adult a couple times to fill in work, maybe worked in three or four different canneries. It's an odd sense of hard work and camaraderie that kind of just takes a hold of you when you're working on a cannery line, particularly if you're working on the line that's the conveyor belt and you're just, you know, shoulder to shoulder with people. You get talking to them because your work is fairly repetitive and monotonous. And you get to know people in a way you would never have the opportunity to know them in any other work experience. And that's real different, too. Interesting. I worked at Alaska. I worked at that, what we used to call it, the Scar of Kodiak. Does it actually say Star of Kodiak on it now? But it looks a lot more shipshape than it did when they first brought it here. It was a pretty ugly, horrible-looking boat right in the end of town. And I worked over in Port Lyons in the Wakefield Cannery, picking shells out of crab, too. And then I worked a time at the Ursin Cannery down here on Shelikoff Avenue when I was maybe 20 years old, to get a little money. I think it was Christmas time or something. But that's a different form of work that I admire people who do it year in and year out. It's not a cinch. That's hard work. But most of the youth here have had a spell of doing that. It's not a particularly odd thing for late teens, early 20s, for everybody here to have worked in a cannery.
What was the impact of media and the television and that advance in technology on you growing up in Kodiak?
I think I made mention of it earlier, the military single station was on late in the morning, maybe even late in the day, and then would be off at like 11 o'clock at night. It didn't have much of an impact on me, really. I remember watching maybe the Johnny Carson show or a sitcom or two. But there wasn't a large variety. A lot of kids that were born and raised here never experienced television elsewhere. You'd talk about what was common to somebody in the lower 48 as far as television, and they wouldn't know what you were talking about here for the longest time. I mean, now we're current with the rest of the world, but it was not that way. It was a very minimal entertainment. The application of TV to Kodiak life was not much.
Okay, we've been off tape for a couple of minutes and we've talked a little bit about this effort being an effort to get a sense of Kodiak and its impact on you, in contrast to how you may have been if you hadn't been raised in Kodiak, and you had some thoughts on that.
Well, I talked about the influence of the people that I knew here when I was a teenager. One of the greatest influences that I had when I was a teenager here was being friends with Maria Springhill Nault and spending time with her, and mainly that was also spending time with her mother, Betty Springhill. Betty treated us, well, almost equally. We'd do stuff together, the three of us. One of the main things that I can remember she did to us quite regularly was read to us. Here we were teenage girls. Like I say, the activities we were having able to do were movies and a dance, and you certainly couldn't do that often. So a lot of evenings were just spent visiting, playing cards, and having Betty read to us, and or just talking and laughing. I can remember one time when we were like seniors, or maybe it was the year after high school, still teenagers. Betty read something to us. She used to read magazines to us, and sometimes whole novels. But she was telling stories and laughing and laughing, and we were all three of us laughing, and Maria said, "You know, you'd be great fun if you just weren't my mother." It bothered her that it was her mother we were having such a wonderful time with. But that was a strong family influence that I'll carry with me forever. Makes me know the value of what I've found now to be the most important relationship you can have in your whole life, and that's between yourself as a woman and your child. There's no words that can describe the bond that is. And in the over 30 years that I've known Betty, she and I've spent many hours talking about what it's like to be a woman, what it's like to be a mother, what it's like to live in Kodiak. And I think of her as a friend, a mentor, and she's had a great influence on my life.
Continuing on in that same vein, what's it like living in Kodiak?
It's special. It's special. Some people talk about the isolation being a burden. You hear people that come here that aren't quite comfortable being here, much like I was when I came here in 61, sort of like you've been just donned a dirty straitjacket or something, can't go anywhere, and the variety of things available to you here are limited. But there's the positive side to that I see, and that is you don't give a damn what's happening in Washington, D.C., or in Paris, or in New York, or Los Angeles. You're just here. And there's a cocoon-like security. I realize it's a false security. I mean, sea lands late, you could miss Thanksgiving. But there's a certain comfort to it nonetheless, like a quilt.
Ah, since you mentioned sea land, were there ever any times that you experienced a lack of things because the van didn't get in for an extended period of time? Or more directly, what's the longest period you've experienced where that occurred?
Well, weeks, certainly weeks. It's never been unusual. More so as you look back in the decades, but it wasn't unusual, and it apparently still seems to be that way. that you can go without milk. You know, people will say, you know, you better get your milk. The ship's not coming in and the stores are low. All those short shelf life products, it's just a way of life to know that you should have a stash of powdered milk or that boxed milk. Those kind of products are few and far between. It's much better now than it ever has been, what with technology and transportation and everything being better, but that was part and parcel of growing up here, not having the fresh foods that you would have elsewhere, simply doing without. Not too many people up until the past 10 years have been industrious enough to do gardens to be of any value to themselves. In Kodiak, in the villages, you had to, but here, being raised in Kodiak, I didn't know too many people in the 60s that had gardens until Bell's Flats came into being. That kind of was that was all started as a hippie. The hippie faction started that section of town, since turned more yuppie, but that was simply Quonset huts that people, well, I don't know how they took ownership of it, whether it was homesteading or purchase or what, but there wasn't anything to look at and shout about out there back in the 60s. There was lots of rabble rousing and partying out there, and that was pretty much it. Now it's a completely taken seriously neighborhood of Kodiak, but it didn't used to be that way. There'd be people running down the dirt roads, and there was even a murder out there in the midst of some party one time. And people just thought, ah, that's Bell's Flats, but it's a legitimate community now. I forget how I got from there to here.
How do you think Kodiak has changed over the years since you've been here?
Well, it's gotten more sophisticated. I won't say cosmopolitan, but there's more people from mainstream America here than there are born and raised old-timers, and their influence has made it more like the rest of the lower 48, as far as I can see.
When you say old-timers, what do you mean by old-timers?
Well, not necessarily born and raised here, but I can remember that on Mill Bay Road, there were very, very few homes. Now there's a few homes and lots of businesses, but I can remember a couple that I rented from being extremely disgusted because there was like five houses in about a 3-block area. And when they'd built there, they were the only house there, and they were just sickened and appalled that they had to put up with an actual neighborhood. They didn't like it. It was an intrusion to them. And I can remember there used to be wild packs of dogs that would run from transient people that would come here, bring their pets, and then leave, and dogs would just run wild. And when there would be too many, there would be a group of men that had nothing to do with a police effort or animal control. It would be just a group of men who decided it was a yearly thing that was done. They would go out and they would shoot the dogs. Now we have structure. We have a police force and we had a police force then too, but the input and control of the people in the community, what their control and their input was greater than what they're able to have now. Now it's more like a city. You go through normal channels now. It was more like a large village.
Would you say that residents took more responsibility for managing their own affairs then than they do now because of laws or regulations?
They took more responsibility because of the lack of laws and regulations, I believe. In what I saw, they would look around their area, their neighborhood, so to speak, and decide what needed to be done and do it. You can't do that so easily now because of the structures that exist, because of the size the community's grown to, and because of the people born and raised and living as adults in other areas and coming here and bringing that structure with them and producing that network that now exists here. It's more like any other city now than it was when I first came here.
We're nearing the end of the first 90 minutes of this. Any final thoughts before we wrap this section up?
Well, no.
If there is one thing you could say about yourself in growing up in Kodiak that you want immortalized in history, what would that be?
I feel very fortunate to have been raised in this community as opposed to have been raised all the way through in Seattle, because I experienced a small town and the closeness that a small town can give you. There was no network. You had to use your own imagination. There was nothing but human to human and imagination. And that worked fine. And would I have experienced that had I stayed in the big city? No, I probably wouldn't have.
All right. Thank you, Mrs. Strabeck.